You're listening to The Critical Point on Aerogel.org. I'm your host, Steven Steiner. Today's podcast, How to Make Silica Aerogel, a topic of apparently great interest for many of our listeners and readers. This is the first in a two-part series focused on the actual process, that is, the art of making silica aerogel, namely lab setup, safety measures, mixing of chemicals, gel processing, and, last but not least, supercritical drying. In this first part, we'll cover everything up until supercritical drying. For those of you without a traditional laboratory workspace, we think you'll find this series particularly helpful. Now, in these two episodes, we won't go into too much detail about the theory or science behind what we're doing, but you can read all about these things under the Learn section here on aerogel.org. With that, I'm here sitting down with aerogel.org co-founder Will Walker, who is going to help walk us through the process of making silica gels suitable for the production of silica aerogel. Will, welcome.
Thanks, Stephen, and hello, everyone. I'm Will.
So, to begin, Will, why don't you tell us a little bit about setting up a laboratory? So many of you out there are probably working in less than ideal situations as far as doing chemistry goes. So either working in a basement or a garage, maybe a high school laboratory, or even a university laboratory that's not well equipped. But that's not to say that you can't make aerogels effectively or safely. And so Will's going to talk a little bit about what it takes to get an effective and safe lab set up.
Sure. Thanks, Stephen. So I would say that I started off really with the foundations. I just had an empty room. I'm also a working artist, so I set aside some space in my studio, a corner near a window that I could use as the space I'd be working. And I advise, you know, no matter where you're working, to give yourself, you know, elbow room and a good flat bench to work on, because if you have a lot of other stuff or you know, just disorganization in the way, it's easy to get confused about your mixtures, it's easy to get confused about what solvents are where you are in the process, and since a lot of things like the diffusion cycles and washing the gels takes days, it's easy to get confused and forget what's what. So I think the two things, just setting up a laboratory and the basics, I don't want to go too far into it, but it's important to have a bench. And it's also important to have a set of shelves or storage space for your solvents and your gels as they're going through the process of being washed in solvent. Is there anything you want to add to that, or anything else you think is really important from your own experience?
Well, I think that there's a certain minimum set of lab supplies that'll be helpful to have as well. For example, have some labeling tape and some permanent markers, and also be aware that as you label stuff, and like you said, it's easy to get confused with if you're making lots of samples. Make sure you label everything and you put dates and what's in it. And
One important thing. Well, go ahead and finish up what you're saying.
No, go ahead.
It's important to have a ground floor entrance and an easy way to bring in heavy tanks.
Oh, well, that's a good point. Yeah, so Will brings up a good point. Especially when you're doing, and we'll get into this later, when you want to do supercritical drying, you need to actually be able to deliver tanks of liquid carbon dioxide in. So whether you're having it delivered by a company like Airgas or Fraxair, or if you're going and getting a tank of liquid CO2 from a welding supplier and bring it in yourself, you definitely are at an advantage if it's not down or up a flight of stairs and you can just wheel or carry these heavy things in on ground level.
Yeah, if you're not trying to handle a 100-pound tank of compressed gas through like a basement window, it's certainly like to your advantage.
That's
so
plus. That's
something to be considering before you set up your laboratory, before you choose your space.
Yes,
so.
If possible, find something on a ground floor. So as I was saying, just about some minimum lab supplies. So it's good to have some labeling tapes, some permanent markers. You're going to want to have a bunch of containers that you can store stuff like gels in. And it's got to be stuff that's going to be compatible. And actually, for doing solvent exchanges and things, a good thing to use is the sort of disposable Tupperware, Gladware kind of stuff. That's actually really good. It's compatible with methanol and ethanol, which it needs to be. And it's cheap and it's big and you can seal it so your solvents won't evaporate. So that's a good stuff. That's good stuff to have on hand. And then also maybe having, if you're if you don't have a vent hood, you can set up a space for working with chemicals and not sort of dosing yourself too badly. Will, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that brings us into the safety aspect, which is probably the next thing that we should
okay,
go
well, yeah,
let's setting up our laboratory. So you have your workspace set up, and now you have to consider, all right, how am I going to stock this so that I'm not constantly exposing myself to solvents? And it's interesting that I came from the field of painting, where we use turpentine and some other kind of nasty solvents, Gamsol, that you have to really pay attention to your ventilation. And so I actually brought that kind of knowledge with me when I started working with aerogels and formulating chemistry. So one thing that's really important is having a window nearby wherever you're doing your formulation. And the easiest way and the most thorough way I've found to set this up on a budget would be to just open up a window the whole way and then place a large box fan in the window and work directly next to the box fan. So you have a small table set up near the window and you're working directly next to the box fan. That way you're facing towards the fan is sucking the air from around you out the window, and you can be relatively certain that the fumes that are coming off of what you're working with are going directly out the window, and you're not breathing them in. That's a good start for ventilation as far as formulations. Normally you don't need a ton of space for this stuff. One other word about ventilation and solvents and storing solvents. Generally speaking, when you have your gels in a bath of solvent like methanol or ethanol, you're going to want to put a lid on them so that they're not just filling up the space with toxic vapors.
Sure.
And you're constantly breathing that in or stewing that in.
So you actually have like a double breather mask that you use for painting and stuff like that. You actually use sometimes when you do formulations, right?
Yeah, for breathing, I use a painter's mask. It comes with, for spray, painting now, they use these spray paint machines, and you would just use like a double breather. The filters are relatively inexpensive. I think you can get them a good quality mask for about $40 these days, and you can change the breathers in. I use organic vapor cartridges.
Yeah,
and they do a pretty good job of keeping me feeling like I'm not breathing in anything too bad.
So I think all this is actually very good advice. Now, when I was in high school, when I was doing this, I did a lot of this stuff in my basement, and the way I mitigated exposure to vapors was by making small samples.
Yes.
And so, by minimizing the size of the gels and by minimizing the amount of solvents that you need, then you can also minimize the amount of the vapors you're exposed to. I also used some pretty relatively benign materials when I was doing it. So that's an acceptable approach too, is to try to substitute something that's unpleasant to work with something that's a little bit more tolerable. But yeah, I think a window, a box fan, and a double breather is a great start. Now, an even better situation for those of you who are fortunate enough to have access to such a resource is a vent hood.
Or ambitious enough to build one.
Oh, that's right. And it's actually possible to build one, and there's some how-to guides on the web for doing that. But what I really, if it's at all possible for you to work in a lab, like most high school chemistry labs have a vent hood or multiple vent hoods, and so if you can set up in there, that's really the most ideal situation.
Community colleges too, that might be another possible resource.
Yeah, and by all means, go ahead and call and email people and just say like, hey, I'm a student or I'm an amateurist in the area, and I'm taking on this project, and I've got a really detailed how-to guide from the web, but I need access to a vent hood. Could I borrow some space for some time? And people are usually very nice at universities and high schools even to help make that possible.
One thing I've learned as an artist is it never hurts to ask.
Never hurts to ask. Don't be afraid to take that risk.
Yeah.
So let's talk about some other safety stuff. What else should you gear up with for
really,
safety?
I think it's important to have a good set of gloves, and those, the lab standard is just to use latex gloves, but I've found that kitchen dish gloves, the kind that you might buy at any grocery store, the yellow gloves work well, and they're reusable, and you can get them in a variety of sizes, so you don't have to worry about the fit as much. So I prefer the kitchen dish gloves. You can, I'm sure there's lab quality stuff. I would also say that it's important to have a pair of safety glasses.
I'm going to interject. It is absolutely necessary to have a pair of safety goggles, something that covers the sides and the underside. So not just a pair of glasses, but something that actually encompasses and seals your face is what you need.
Mm-hmm.
And those you can buy at university bookstores for, you know, a few dollars. You can get them on the web.
Hardware stores,
absolutely.
Home Depot carries them. Yeah.
So, absolutely, you must. And I will personally forbid you from using anything on aerogel.org unless you're wearing a pair of goggles.
All right.
So we got gloves, we got goggles, and also going to throw in there, too, and this is standard for any lab practice. When you're doing chemistry, wear long pants and do not wear open-toed shoes or sandals or flip-flops, because if you spill something, it's going to go straight onto your skin, onto your foot. If you drop something, it's just not good, okay?
Glassware, if you're working with glassware, yeah, it's just good to have that stuff around.
And by all means, like, I know if you're in your house, you might be wearing socks or something, but, like, you know, just don't wear shoes, okay? And make sure you're wearing long pants, make sure that you've got you got your gloves and you got your goggles on when you're doing this. And getting an apron is nice too, in case you spill anything, you know, get on the apron, not on you.
Sure. So I guess next thing up, once you've got your safety stuff on, you're wearing an apron, you're wearing long sleeves, you got your gloves on, your mask, and your glasses, then you're gonna want to start mixing stuff up. And this is where, you know, it's easy to look at a chemistry lab ordering book and think that this is going to cost a ton of money for all these beakers and glassware, but really you can do it for pretty cheap. We use for our primary mixing containers, I use simple Bodum French press coffee beakers, which form an excellent beaker for mixing a fairly large sample, and they're easy to clean, and then they're pretty cheap, pretty good way to, like, you know, have a flask to mix up your sets in.
When I was in high school, I actually collected and washed out Gerber baby food jars, sort of like the large size ones, and those are glass, they're nice jars that are good for pouring and for mixing in. You can also anything that's polypropylene. So you can find a lot of disposable cups and things at the grocery store, at hardware stores. Things that are made out of polypropylene are pretty much inert for all the chemistry that you need to do. So those are always good to use as well.
Would a Pyrex measuring cup do a decent job too?
Yeah, you could use a Pyrex measuring cup, but I would be hesitant to use it for measuring. I would simply use it for mixing.
Sure, just to have the container that is easy to pour because it's got a spout on it.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I like the coffee presses. All right, so you know you have that. Then you're also going to need you're going to have to figure out how you're going to measure your chemistry.
Yeah, that's perhaps the hardest part about setting up is, like, how are you going to measure stuff? So there's really two ways of doing it. There's you can weigh stuff, or you can measure by volume. So I think the more accurate way, to get more reproducible results, it's best to use a scale. And actually, Will got a scale on eBay for, I guess it was like $150, $200.
$200 of shipping, probably around there.
But it's, and for that, you're going to want something that measures to a sensitivity of 0.01 grams. So not tenth, but hundredths of a gram.
Yes, and you're going to want to have something, you know, ideally, the one that we got has a little level on it. It's got adjustable feet, so you can make sure that it's level. It has came with a weight so that you could always make sure that it was properly teared or zeroed.
Calibrated, yeah.
Calibrated, yes. And another nice thing to have when you're working with a hundredth of a gram is an enclosure around the actual scale to keep, like, breezes from adjusting the weight. It can be really frustrating if your weight is always the weight that you're reading is going up and down all the time just because there's airflow from your fan, for example, that you've got
especially,
set right next
exactly.
to it.
Exactly. So
I often find that having, being able to close it off with a little glass door, you know, that's great. So those tend to look like little boxes coming off.
And actually, usually when you buy the scale, more often than not, they come with an enclosure already around them. But, you know, it's something that you could rig up pretty easy if you needed to.
You know, baking scale's not going to have enclosure.
Right, yeah, no, and postal scales. That's the thing, yeah. Postal scales and baking scales are really not accurate enough to do useful measurements, unless you're making kind of
large
volume. Well, you know, I mean, like 50 to 100 milliliter mixes, in which case, you know, maybe you could get away with it, but it's, you know, best to have something a little more accurate. The other way to do this is volumetrically, and so this is if you're in a high school or a university lab, you probably can easily find some volumetric pipettes graduated pipettes. That allows you to simply suck up liquids and kind of see, you know, measure how many milliliters you're sucking up, and then squirt that into your beaker or whatever. And actually, a lot of that glassware you can also find on eBay and on the internet for reasonably cheap. You can get sets of pipettes and things like that. I used volumetric measurements, and a lot of scientists use volumetric measurements, especially if you get what's called a volumetric pipette that has like an etched laser line on it. Then you can measure precisely, you know, it's 1.00 milliliters or 5.00 milliliters, and that can actually be very accurate. So either way is really acceptable.
So at this point, I guess you'd say you've got your measuring equipment. You're going to need a formula.
You do need a formula. I'm going to interject one more thing into getting ready, which would be dealing with spills and waste. And mm-hmm. So what you're going to want is to have some kind of a tray, like a pan, like some kind of a metal pan like you'd use for catching oil under a car. And find some empty bottles, like soda bottles would be fine, that when you've got waste that you can pour it in and store it in there. And actually, most of the waste you're going to generate making silica aerogels ends up being just mostly alcohol and maybe a little bit of ammonia. And it ends up being a really good solvent. So you could use it for household, reuse it for household solvent stuff. And if you, you can get rid of it either at a sort of municipal toxic waste collection day, or go and talk to a high school or a university nearby, which has waste streams that go and are properly handled, and you can sometimes convince them to take a, you know, small amount of your waste that you generate and to kind of fold that in with their waste stream as well.
This is important because you don't want jars and vials and bottles full of solvent building up in your laboratory.
Yeah, I mean, both from a health and a safety standpoint, but, you know, importantly to the environment. We're hoping that aerogels are going to make the world a better place, and we don't want to, you know, end up killing the world with all these solvents while we're doing that. All right, so now we need a formula.
Sure.
So let's talk about the formula a little bit. So the basis of making the gels that you use for making silica aerogels is what's called sol-gel chemistry. And to do that, we're going to be using a silicon alkoxide, reacting it with water in a solvent in which both are miscible, so a co-solvent, which is going to be alcohol. And then we're going to add a catalyst, which will help to make the chemical reactions proceed on a time scale that's suitable for making a gel. So we're going to be using a procedure here that was contributed by Michael Grogan from the University of Bath in the United Kingdom. And we would like to thank Michael for his contribution. It's a very nice procedure. It's actually very similar to a process I've been using for a couple years for making nice transparent silica aerogels. So this process uses tetramethoxysilane, or T-MOS, as the silicon alkoxide. It uses methanol as the solvent, and then water and ammonium hydroxide for the hydrolysis and the catalysis. And so usually when you're making silica gels, the way you do this is you prepare sort of a solution A and a solution B. Now, solution A is going to contain the alkoxide and a little bit of methanol, and solution B is going to contain water, your catalyst, and then a little bit of methanol. And then you pour the catalyst solution, the solution B, into your solution A. You mix it up, and then within a matter of minutes, about 10 to 15 minutes, the liquid will reach infinite viscosity and become a gel. And so a couple things to note. So first of all, tetramethoxysilane is not a particularly great chemical to breathe in. So it's really important that you have a good ventilation like we sort of set up. Additionally, methanol is dangerous to get in your eyes. It will blind you. So do not get it in your eyes. Do not drink it. It is not drinking alcohol. Don't get any stupid ideas here. It's a chemical.
Methanol is also used as a fuel in some circumstances. So it's highly flammable.
Yes, that's right. So is T-Moss. T-Moss is flammable too. So just keep those things in mind. Be wearing your goggles. And it's probably good to...
not good to be doing chemistry by candlelight in this.
that's right. Yeah, that's a good thing. We have electric lights. And also ammonium hydroxide, the catalyst you're going to use, smells terrible. It is this awful pungency. It comes up and grabs you in the nose. And it's real sharp. You can detect it at very low concentration in the air. It'll smell very strong at very low concentrations. So I think more than, it's not so much that it's hazardous as much as it's just extremely unpleasant. It might give you a bit of a headache. So that's another thing you want to just keep well ventilated. So what we're going to do here is we're going to make solution A. I've kind of scaled this recipe in two different ways. So if you want to make a small, very small sample, that's on the order of about, 7 milliliters in volume. You could use this first version of it. And then if you want to make several gels or a larger gel, then this scale version would work well. So the way this works is solution A, we would put in 2 milliliters of T-Moss, that's tetramethoxysilane, and 2 milliliters of methanol, and we would mix that up.
And then, I would say one thing, quick word about mixing. It's good to be consistent in these matters. If you swirling is generally the accepted practice for mixing chemicals together. Is that correct?
So. Well, I would say it. Swirling is a fine way to mix chemicals.
There we go.
It's good to make sure that these are mixed, but generally this stuff
opposed to shaking or something that can yield lots of stuff flying everywhere.
Well, yeah. So shaking things tends to introduce bubbles or air dissolved in the liquid, which can come out later. So, swirl the beaker, and that'll get the stuff mixed up. Now, in a separate beaker, you're going to put in 1 milliliter of water, 2 milliliters of methanol, and then a very small amount of ammonium hydroxide. It's 5.4 microliters. Now, let me tell you a little bit about how that works. Now, if you're just trying to make a gel and you're not real concerned about the quality or how reproducible it is, what you could do is just take like a syringe or something. An eyedropper is a really really good to use for this, and just put like one drop of concentrated ammonium hydroxide. So the stuff you're going to want would be like 28 to 30% ammonium hydroxide. You can get it from Sigma Aldrich. Actually, all these chemicals you can get from Sigma Aldrich and many other places. So household cleaning ammonia is a little bit too dilute and sometimes contains perfume and some other things in it. So it's better to get actually like laboratory ammonia to get this to work properly. Now, 5.4 microliters is very small amount. If you're in a university or a high school, you might have a micropipetter that you can dial in that amount and then pipette it in. The better way to do it is to make a stock solution. So what you would do with that is put 5.4 milliliters of concentrated ammonium hydroxide into a flask and then dilute it with water to 1,000 milliliters. I guess I should say a word about the water as well. You're going to want to make sure that this isn't just tap water. You're going to want to use at a minimum distilled water that you can get at the grocery store, but much preferably use deionized water. And even better yet, if you can get sort of high quality, like analytical reagent grade deionized water from a supplier like Sigma Aldrich or Fisher or VWR, that would give you even better results. And actually, Michael Grogan, who contributed the recipe, points out that unless you use analytical reagent grade water, your gels will be prone to cracking at some point down the line. So don't use tap water, and preferably use a higher quality water if you can. So making a stock solution actually is a really good practice when you need to get low concentrations of stuff, because what it does is it allows you to measure, to take a measurable amount of something. Like, you know, I can measure 5.4 milliliters of ammonium hydroxide pretty easily, and then, you know, dilute it to 1,000 milliliters. And then of that stuff, you know, mix that up really well, and then take 1 milliliter of that as your 1 milliliter of water. Mm-hmm. And then the necessary amount of ammonium hydroxide will already be included in there. And that should be very reproducible from run to run then, since the solution's homogenous. So let's just review it one more time. Beaker with solution A, 2 milliliters of T-MOS, 2 milliliters of methanol. Beaker with solution B, 1 milliliter of your ammonium hydroxide containing water and 2 milliliters of methanol. Both of those respectively stirred up. Now we're going to pour solution B into solution A, swirl them up together very well. Give it about 30 seconds of swirl, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then let it sit. And within 8 to 15 minutes, depending on, you know, human error, some atmospheric conditions, and maybe you know, the actual concentration of your ammonia, you'll get a gel to form within about 8 to 15 minutes. Depending on the age of your ammonium hydroxide, its actual concentration, experimental error, and sometimes even environmental conditions, you might find that your gel time is less than or greater than what we say it's supposed to be. So in that case, you're going to want to adjust the amount of catalyst to get the gel time right around 10 minutes if possible. So either by reducing the amount of catalyst while keeping all the other amounts of stuff the same to lengthen the gel time, or by increasing the amount of catalyst to speed the gel time up. This is actually kind of important, because if the gel time's too fast, you might find that the gel is that the resulting aerogel is weaker or less transparent than you might want it to be. And similarly, if the gel time's too long, it may also not be as clear or strong as you expected it would be originally. So it's important to get the gel time sort of not too short but not too long, and instead right in the right range. So now, instead, if you want to do this at a little bit larger scale, you can scale everything just by multiplying it times the scaling factor. So if you want to make a 5x scale of this, you would take 10 milliliters of T-MOS and 10 milliliters of methanol for your solution A. You would take 5 milliliters of your stock solution of ammonium hydroxide in water with 10 milliliters of methanol. Swirl that up as your solution B, pour solution B into solution A, and mix that up. And then either if you want a gigantic gel like that you want to break up later, or you want to keep as a big monolith, then you can let it set like that. Or alternatively, you can split it up into a series of smaller molds before the gel point is reached and make a bunch of little monoliths.
Quick note about making larger gels. If you have one flask and you finished, you know, mixing up solution A, and then you have to mix together solution B, it might be a good idea to cover solution A while you're doing that.
Yeah, this stuff actually takes longer to do than you might expect. So I was like, oh, just do this, do that. But actually, it can take, you know, 10 or 20 minutes to make something that's got, you know, two
measurable,
or two,
you know, yeah. When you're talking about a solvent like methanol, there's going to be measurable evaporation. So
yeah, so that's a good thing to do. You know, aluminum foil is fine.
Yes.
Be careful if you're using wax paper or saran wrap. You know, test to make sure it doesn't dissolve with your methanol, because yeah. Who knows, you know, if you buy some cheap saran wrap, what it's really made out of.
Yeah.
So that's the gist of making the gels. Now, I guess a word about molds.
Sure.
Actually, Will, you have some good insights on this. In general, aerogels aren't very machinable, so you want to cast the gel in the shape that you want the aerogel to be. Keeping in mind that the actual aerogel, by the method that we're going to be talking about in this podcast and the next next, the follow-on episode, these aerogels will shrink about 5% relative to the volume of the original gel, and it's isotropically, so that means it shrinks sort of in all directions about 5% relative to the original gel. So casting it into a mold is actually a bit of an art, and so, Will, why don't you tell us a little about some materials and methods for doing that?
Well, we've got a couple of different solutions we've tried, some with more success than others, and I would say, you know, working from the most successful stuff we've used has been Teflon so far, which is kind of a white plastic, very, very slick, used in cookware.
But it's expensive.
It is expensive, but if you can have it machined or made into the mold that you want, you're going to find that demolding is usually no problem, that if you want to super critically dry your gels in the mold, they won't crack because they won't be gripping the surface very hard. We've used aluminum with success, as long as you're using compatible chemistry.
You want to make sure that the aluminum is smooth, because and that's true with any of these molds. You want to make sure the mold surface is very smooth. Mm-hmm. You can even lubricate it or spray it with like a silicone spray or
silicone
grease
a really
ahead of time
to
make
it
smooth. Yeah. So aluminum or stainless steel, same thing.
Glass, glassware is fine.
A test tube is perfect.
Yes.
Really
that's
good.
Often done.
Yeah.
Polypropylene, I know. It's often that what they'll do is actually what chemists who are working with X-aerogels or aerogels in general will do is use a syringe with the top cut off, and they'll fill the syringe with the syringe plunger all the way open. And then when they're ready to, once the gel has gelled, they'll actually close the syringe or depress the plunger, and the gel will just pop right out into the
solvent. It pushes out, and you can push it into a bath of solvent.
Right. Bath of solvent.
And actually, as far as getting syringes, if you go to Walgreens or CVS and you ask for like a baby oral syringe, you can usually get one from the pharmacy counter, and they'll give you one or two. And actually, sometimes you'll find syringes in kits like of different things they sell at the grocery store. Otherwise, you can buy these on the internet as well. Actually, as far as polypropylene goes, also at Walgreens or CVS, if you ever see these boxes that you like a weekly pill box where you have like a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday kind of compartments for putting your medicine in, actually those are usually made out of polypropylene or some kind of a polyethylene, which is compatible, and they're nice little rectangular boxes that are right, just the right size for the autoclave that you, or the manuclave rather, that you'd build on aerogel.org. And so sort of the scale of the liquids that we're talking about mixing up here would sort of fit nicely into these little compartments. So what you can do is just with like a knife, like a kitchen knife, it's very soft plastic, you can cut the compartments apart and make like an isolated little box mold. They have a little cap, like a little like snap down lid, and so you can fill it up part way, snap down the lid, and let the gel set, and then you can, you know, cut it apart and push the gel out, or you can either like maybe knife a hole in the bottom of it to make it easier to push the gel out after the gel set. Mm-hmm. So that's just something, some creative things in your neighborhood that you might have access to if you want to look for some nice regular geometric molds for making aerogels.
You know, at this point, I think there's a lot of different methods out there, and I think that everybody's kind of looking for their own method. It depends on your application. You know, we've experimented around with silicon rubber as well as to make a cast mold. But I think this is one of those things where the open source community, if anybody is out there and experimenting with things, we'd love to hear about it because, you know, there is no one definitive solution for this problem.
Absolutely. It's really application specific. Actually, and one thing that Michael Grogan contributed was he's interested in making very high transparency silica aerogels, and so what he does is takes these PMMA, polymethyl methacrylate, or plexiglass, that same plastic, acrylic is generally called acrylic, and he's casting the gels in those. Now, usually I steer away from that because acrylic actually will end up dissolving in a lot of the, or softening in a lot of the solvents that you end up using for making aerogels. But he actually uses it to that to his advantage. He casts the gel in that in these PMMA cuvettes, and then during the solvent exchange, the plastic softens, and you can peel it away and have very nice flat edges to your material. Mm-hmm. So that's a very creative kind of solution, and kind of exploiting material incompatibility, I guess.
Yeah, you're so. Just going to find out. I mean, anybody who's doing this process is going to find out how finicky these suckers are when they're in your gel stage. So, like, right. You know, any way that you can not touch them, not have personal contact with them, yeah. or introduce your own movement into them is going
to... Not take, yeah. The other thing to note, too, is if you make large pieces, they can be very difficult to handle, and they can kind of collapse under their own weight as you move them around. So that takes us to the next step and the last thing that we're going to cover in this podcast today, which is going to be aging and solvent exchange in preparation for supercritical drying. So
sure. So as you're casting your gels in their molds, you're going to want to have a container to set the gels in to age. And one thing I would really like to kind of recommend here is a Pyrex dish that you can get at Walmart, and they come with, now they're selling them with silicone rubber molds. With the silicone rubber lids. This is great because the lids are relatively airtight. I've left gels for 2 months and not had the solvent evaporate.
Pyrex glassware is really nice.
Yeah, the Pyrex glassware. It's easy to clean. It's easy to use, and they're very convenient. They stack very flat. If you're running multiple loads of gels, they're great to use. So what you're going to do is you're going to take your gels, and before they've gelled completely, once you have your molds filled with the solution A, solution B mixture, you're going to place them into your Pyrex container or whatever kind of container you're using to do the solvent exchange, and you're going to let them sit there. But one thing that you're going to do is take a small amount of your solvent, if it's methanol in this case, and just put down a layer on the bottom of the your container, not so that it touches the mold and disrupts the formulation, but just so that it'll start to fill the atmosphere surrounding the gels with vapors, so that the gels won't dry out and crack.
You're going to put the lid on.
Yes, put the lid back on, and then you're going to leave them and let them sit.
So what Will's talking about is a good idea, especially if you have long gel times. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I should note, in doing your formulations, this particular formulation will give you aerogels of a particular density. If you want to make them more dense or less dense, the way you do this is by adjusting the volume of methanol. And what you'll find is if you add too much methanol, the gel simply won't form. If you add more methanol in general, you'll make a less dense gel. If you use less methanol, you'll make a more dense gel. However, the gel time will also either lengthen or shorten accordingly. So the less dense the gel, the longer the gel time is likely to be. And so if you have a longer gel time, now the formulation we just put out there is about 10-minute gel time. And so you probably won't need to do this kind of putting it in a Pyrex dish with a solvent atmosphere in that short amount of time. But if you have something that's like an hour or like a day kind of a gel time, then absolutely you need to do this. It doesn't do any harm to do it at this point either, though. Mm-hmm. So once the gels have set, you have a sort of a dilemma of whether you leave it in the mold or you take it out of the mold. And so the risk of taking it out of the mold is it might damage it. And so that's some creativity gets to go into that on your part in terms of figuring out what the best way to demold your gels is going to be.
But the problem with leaving the gels in the mold, which is the safer way to go as far as their structure, is that then you're talking about a much longer diffusion time.
And the diffusion time pertaining to purifying the gels through solvent exchanges and then eventually in supercritical drying. So all of these steps that follow the formation of the gel, we need to next age the gel, purify the gel, and then solvent exchange the gel into liquid CO2, and finally supercritically dry it. Each of those steps is diffusion controlled, which means they take a long time. We're basically just letting molecules diffuse their way through and take care of all this. And so when you have a gel that is all of its surface is exposed, the diffusion time will be the smallest it can be. And if you have or if you have five sides of a cube sort of blocked off in a mold and just the top exposed to the liquid, then it's got to diffuse through that one side and it becomes exponentially longer diffusion time. So that's sort of the trade-off, I guess. So the aging that Will mentioned is actually a very important process. So what you're going to want to do is as soon as your gel sets, you're going to either in its mold or demolded, put it into a bath of 20% water and 80% methanol. And what this is, and let that soak in there for, you know, a day or two. What this is going to do is to help the chemical reactions sort of go to completion and help strengthen the gel network. So realizing that after the gel sets, its internal silica skeleton has, while it has, you know, officially gelled, it is still changing. It's still sort of finishing up some loose ends as far as bonding and strengthening goes. So sitting in this bath of water and methanol will help the gel to finish reacting and to be optimally strong and high quality for transparency later on. Once this aging process has been done, you're going to want to replace that aging bath with just pure methanol, and you're going to want to let your gels soak in an excess of methanol, so many times more, you know, 5 to 10 or even more times the volume of the gel in methanol, so sitting in a jar of methanol, a little gel or something. And if you're using a Pyrex dish, you know, make sure that you're not chalking the dish full of gels.
No, well covered, you know, yeah, and like have plenty of space.
Exactly. You want to make sure there's an excess of solvent. Let the gels soak in the solvent for at least 12 hours, on the order of 24 hours is probably
per exchange,
right.
Yeah.
And then replace that methanol, so carefully draining, pouring off the liquid, and pouring new methanol in, and then repeating that process at least 3 times, preferably 4 times. So that is, we're doing, now each of these infusions and then dumpings of liquids is what we call a solvent exchange. So you're going to want to do at least 4 solvent exchanges at 24-hour intervals before we then can proceed on to supercritical drying. Now, what this is doing is this is taking excess water, ammonia, and other things that are sort of floating around in the pores of the gel that didn't incorporate into the gel structure, and it diffuses them out and replaces them with pure methanol. And why do we care about this? Well, when we actually want to supercritically dry these gels and turn them into aerogels, if there's excess water or other junk in the pores, when the supercritical drying process is done, that's actually going to be left over.
Because the carbon dioxide, the liquid carbon dioxide that you're using in your autoclave or your manuclave is not going to be able to dissolve those particular
exactly.
materials.
Now, CO2 is very non-polar, mm-hmm. and water is very polar. So that stuff is going to just stick, you know, and hug the backbone of the silica as long as it can. And so neither the liquid nor the supercritical CO2 is going to pull it out. Mm-hmm. So you want to get that stuff out with methanol in advance, and then the methanol can exchange very homogeneously, very effectively with, it's totally miscible, that is, with liquid CO2. And then any residual methanol that happens to be left after we do solvent exchanges with liquid CO2 will get pulled out by the supercritical extraction process for the most part, and allow you to make a high quality transparent aerogel. So that said, we're going to allow you to go ahead and make your gels and age them and solvent exchange them with methanol. And then next time in this two-part series, we'll talk about the solvent exchange that follows the methanol solvent exchanges, which is exchanging the gels into liquid carbon dioxide in a pressure vessel, and then finally supercritically drying them to make aerogels.
Yeah, I think we've given everyone out there ample homework.
There we go. Yeah, ample homework. So for aerogel.org, this has been Steven Steiner. And
I'm Will Walker.
Reminding you that aerogel is not just for NASA anymore. Log on and get involved. Thanks for listening.